This is the Environment Show. It's about our stewardship of the Earth and the beauty and mystery of life in all its forms. I'm Peter Burley. Coming up, we look at efforts to heal the Earth and its critters. A $7.8 billion plan to restore the Florida Everglades has been completed and submitted to Congress. It's the largest ecological restoration plan in history. With protection of the Endangered Species Act and elimination of DDT, the peregrine falcon, one of the world's fastest birds, is making a comeback. Some are nesting on city skyscrapers. Inner-city citizens organized to stop the stink of a sewage treatment plant in their neighborhood. And on the Earth calendar, organic squash, zucchini, and cucumbers are being picked in Colorado. It's part of the Great American Harvest. These stories and more coming up on The Environment Show. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Plans for the largest ecosystem restoration program in history have just been submitted to Congress for funding and approval. The aim is to bring the Florida Everglades back to health. 90% of the birds that inhabited the Everglades 70 years ago are now gone. The glades are drying up because drainage ditches and water gates built by the Corps of Engineers over the last half century for flood control and farmland development are sending the water to the ocean that used to flow over and nourish the river of grass.
Well, the key part of the plan is to capture the nearly 1.7 billion gallons of water that's being lost out to the ocean and to the Gulf of Mexico on average every day. Once you capture it, you also have to do some other things. You have to make sure that it's clean water. And so we have to make sure we have facilities in place to clean the water where necessary. We also have to make sure that we have our facilities in place so that we can distribute the water where we need to in the natural system and when we need to. So there's four really kind of fundamental components to restoring the Everglades. It's quantity, quality, timing, and distribution, and our plan will address all four of those factors.
That's Michael Davis, Deputy Assistant Secretary for the Army for Civil Works. He'll be in charge of overseeing the restoration construction projects to be carried out by the Corps of Engineers. Originally in rainy season, water was naturally stored in Lake Okeechobee, north of the Everglades. It then seeped southward through the River of Grass. After severe flooding around the lake more than 50 years ago, Congress authorized the Corps to ditch the area so water would be drained immediately east and west into the sea. This has caused the glades to be starved for water, a condition that must be corrected if the system is to be restored. Again, Mike Davis.
This plan allows us to, when we have high water periods, the natural high water period, which is the wet season that typically starts in June or July in South Florida, we can store that high water. Instead of just releasing it out to the ocean and the Gulf, we can store it in surface water storage facilities. We can store it in underground water storage facilities called aquifer storage and recovery facilities. And that allows us then to have the water available when we need it at the right time of the year.
Elements of the storage proposals are untested. This troubles Malcolm Wade, Vice President of the United States Sugar Corporation, which is one of the big sugar producers in the agricultural area.
There's a concern, I think, on all stakeholders that we're really, what this plan comprises of is several very large unproven technologies. When I say that, the real backbone of this plan are three technologies: aquifer storage and recovery wells, above ground reservoirs, and seepage barriers. The aquifer storage and recovery wells are 333 1.5 million gallon a day wells that are being put throughout South Florida, and it's to pump water down in the ground several thousand feet and then to be able to recover it when you need the water and pull it back up. And there's significant water quality considerations as to the quality of the water you're putting down in our aquifers, which are used for the drinking water throughout South Florida. And also what it's going to do as the impact on the aquifers when you start putting that much water down into it.
Wade also has concerns about whether the proposed reservoirs, the first of which will be 62 square miles in size, will actually hold water, and whether the underground walls to be built to prevent water seepage will be effective. Nevertheless, Wade says the Florida sugar industry supports the plan, which can be modified as it is implemented. Water released into the glades needs to be clean, free not only of pesticides and herbicides, but also of fertilizers. If the water contains nutrients like phosphates, growth of cattails and other alien species which change the ecosystem is stimulated. The restoration plan calls for the construction of almost 100,000 acres of wetlands to clean the water. Both urban and agricultural runoff will be diverted through them, and wetland plants will purify the water before it is released into the glades. Everglades restoration will not be cheap. The price tag is $7.8 billion. U.S. Senator Bob Graham, who started the Save the Everglades campaign when he was governor 16 years ago, thinks the money will come.
Congress has been very supportive of the Everglades, as have several administrations, both Republican and Democratic. The Congress has authorized, since the Save Our Everglades program began in 1983, some $2.5 billion for projects that have already been completed or are underway in the Everglades. So with that history, I am optimistic that the Congress and the state of Florida, which will be 50-50 partners in the restoration of the Everglades, will both come forward with their very significant requirements, approximately $200 million a year from each partner for the next 20 years.
The Everglades Restoration Plan has been long in formulation, with hundreds of scientists, engineers, governmental officials, and activists participating. Its submission to Congress is a milestone. Again, Florida Senator Bob Graham.
Well, I'm extremely excited about where we are now. In 1983, many people were ready to literally throw in the towel for the Florida Everglades. A number of us resisted that pessimistic scenario and launched the Save Our Everglades program in 1983. This is a very important new chapter in that book of salvation, and I am optimistic, excited, and believe that we can leave to future generations of Americans one of the great environmental treasures in our country, and leave to the world an example of how a degraded system under enormous population and economic pressure can be resurrected.
The world's fastest bird is making a comeback. That's the message from fish and wildlife officials who are involved in saving the peregrine falcon. 30 years ago, the harmful effects of a well-publicized pesticide brought the bird to the brink of extinction. But today, experts say peregrine populations are large enough to remove them from the endangered species list. The Environment Show's Stephen Westcott has more on this environmental success story.
The peregrine falcon is one of nature's fastest predators. When attacking prey, it can reach speeds of 200 miles per hour and grab other birds in midair. One observer who saw a peregrine bag a pigeon said it looked as though the pigeon had flown into an egg beater. Peregrines stand 15 to 21 inches tall. They're about the size of a crow.
The juveniles have a brown plumage on the back and a lighter brown on the breast. The adults have a dark helmet appearance on their heads. Their backs are a slate blue, and their breasts are typically a cream color. The feet and fleshy part of the beak on the juveniles is bluish green. On the adults is yellowish orange. The females are about one-third larger than the males.
That's Bill Burnham, president of the Peregrine Fund, a nonprofit organization that was established in 1970. At that time, only about 320 nesting pairs of peregrine falcons remained in North America. Like the bald eagles and some other birds, Burnham says the pesticide DDT was the major cause of the decline of peregrine falcons.
Even though very low concentrations may have been used initially, the multiplying effect was so great, and it caused eggshell thinning in peregrine falcons, so that when the female incubated the eggs, many times they broke or the embryos otherwise died. So there was limited or no reproduction, and as the older birds died off, there were simply no replacements, and so the populations declined.
So many peregrines had been lost by the early 1970s, none of the birds could be found east of the Mississippi River, and only about 10% of the western population remained. The peregrine falcon was listed as an endangered species in 1970 in an effort to save the bird from extinction. 2 years later, the Environmental Protection Agency banned DDT, and today the number of peregrine falcons is growing. Robert Mesta is peregrine falcon coordinator with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Ventura, California.
According to surveys conducted in 1998, there are currently 1,657 known pairs in North America, and that includes southern Alaska, Canada, the U.S., and northern Mexico. Our goal for North America, our goal set for a major recovery, was 631.
Besides the banning of DDT, the Peregrine Fund's Bill Burnham says the bird's ability to adapt is a contributing factor to its survival.
When we think of peregrine falcons, we usually think of their habitat as being mountainous areas with large cliffs. However, more recently, since the restoration program began, we're also thinking of peregrine falcons in relationship to urban environments. There are many pairs nesting in cities, not only in North America, but other places in the world, nesting on large buildings and hunting the bird life that occurs in cities such as pigeons, and particularly pigeons. So they have adapted very well to exist in human environments.
Burnham says more than a dozen pairs of peregrine falcons have taken up residence among the skyscrapers and tall bridges of New York City. Overall, the recovery of the peregrine falcon is the result of efforts by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, state and local officials, volunteers, and many others, including the Peregrine Fund. Again, Bill Burnham.
This is probably the largest restoration effort that has ever been attempted in the world, I would guess. Peregrine falcons, totaling over 6,000, these are captive hatched, were released in the United States and Canada. The idea was to bolster remnant populations, for example, in the western United States and some places in Canada, and then reestablish populations that had been lost, such as in the eastern United States. And it's been a tremendous effort involving thousands of people.
In honor of the return of the peregrine falcon, Bill Burnham says the Peregrine Fund and others are sponsoring the North American Peregrine Falcon Celebration, scheduled for August 20th and 21st in Boise, Idaho. He hopes the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will officially announce the delisting of the falcon around that time. If the peregrine is delisted, it will continue to be protected by the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, which protects migrating birds in Canada, the United States, and Mexico. Also, U.S. Fish and Wildlife is obligated to monitor the recovery of a species for at least 5 years after it is delisted. It's good news for a bird that has returned from the brink of extinction. For The Environment Show, I'm Stephen Westcott.
The Environment Show is a national production. It's made possible by the W. Walton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Contact us anytime here at The Environment Show. Our email address is green@wamc.org. That's green@wamc.org. Telephone is 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. We'll be right back. We want to take a moment to update you on a story we reported. Last week, we told you about Weyerhaeuser Company's proposed purchase of McMillan Bloedel, a company that owns the logging rights to some 6 million acres of forest lands. At the time the story was produced, Weyerhaeuser was not willing to honor the pledge by McMillan Bloedel to phase out clear-cutting in the coastal rainforests of British Columbia, Canada. Recently, Weyerhaeuser announced it will honor the commitment, as well as a pledge McMillan Bloedel made to native peoples, to protect forest areas with sensitive ecological and aboriginal values. We'll keep you informed about this and other stories in the future.
I'm Leah Fleming, and this is Ear to the Ground, with stories about people affecting change in the environment. This week, West Harlem Environmental Action Group, working for environmental justice in urban communities of color. People of color and low-income individuals in urban neighborhoods across the country are working to protect their communities from disproportionate environmental and community development efforts. They make up the environmental justice movement. In 1988, as a result of community struggles around the siting of a number of polluting facilities, in one such community in New York City, the West Harlem Environmental Action Group, known as WEACT, emerged. It is a general advocacy and education organization made up of 7 staff members and several volunteers who work to improve environmental quality of life and environmental health in communities of color. It was co-founded by Vernice Miller, now Director of Environmental Justice at the Natural Resources Defense Council, and Peggy Shepherd, Director of WEACT. Shepherd, a former magazine editor and candidate for Assembly District Leader in West Harlem, first got involved in environmental issues in 1988 when the Harlem community came to her for help with the North River Sewage Treatment Plant, a $2 billion, 170 million gallon a day plant built and managed by the city. Peggy Shepherd says this is the issue that WEACT is best known for.
Earlier in the year, Mayor Dinkins had committed $55 million in a 5-year plan to fix the plant and to correct the kinds of problems that we had been experiencing with that plant. Now, this is a sewage treatment plant that's 8 blocks long, right across the street from Riverside Drive, from people's homes. It's a plant that was spewing noxious odors and emissions. People were experiencing respiratory problems, increased incidence of asthma, as well as foul odors. And this plant was severely impacting people's health and the way people felt about their community and where they lived. And the community mobilized around this issue. We were able to raise the issue in the media. We organized numbers of rallies and civil disobedience where people got arrested, and we made this a city issue. And because of that, the city settled a $1.1 million settlement for an environmental benefits fund for the West Harlem community to be used for projects that enhance the quality of life.
WEACT's work is complemented by many other groups like it throughout the country. They are dispelling the myth that low-income and people of color don't get involved in environmental issues. Again, Peggy Shepherd.
This organization exists, as well as several others, because community residents mobilized around environmental issues in the Harlem community. We began working on the North River Sewage Treatment Plant that was sited in this community instead of downtown where it originally was to be located. It was moved up to this community because it was felt that this community was less informed about these issues, less organized, and less politically active and politically strong. And this community spoke out initially about the poor operations of that plant, about the health impacts of that plant, and sought leadership, and we began working together. About 200 people meeting every month around this issue for a number of years. So that just isn't my experience. That's just a stereotype that people have, frankly, because they don't want to be bothered in dealing with community residents in terms of policy.
WE Act is involved in many community programs, but the biggest attention is on their youth leadership development program.
It's approximately 12 to 13 junior high and high school age students, and we train them around environmental issues, civic and community issues. They do numbers of projects like open space greening projects. They get involved in air monitoring, which, you know, air quality is a very crucial issue in this community.
And Shepherd says 60% of the organization's time is spent on children's environmental health issues. Shepherd says WE Act has just been funded for 4 years to continue working with junior high school students. This will enable her to share her commitment with young people. With Ear to the Ground, I'm Leah Fleming.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. Organic summer squash, zucchini, and cucumbers are being picked in Colorado. It's part of the Great American Harvest. Byron Fish owns and operates Columbine Gardens, a 190-acre farm in Cortez, Colorado, located in the southwestern part of the state. It's near the Four Corners region where Utah, Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona meet. Of the 30 acres of organic vegetables, about 10 are dedicated to squash and cucumbers, and it takes a big team to get the crop off the field.
When we hit the peak part of the season, we'll have 8 or 10 employees out there, at least part-time. It's all handwork. None of this can be done with machinery. We'll pick around a ton of zucchini a day for about 60 days, and we box them right in the field, just from the bush right into a box, and the little PLU stickers, certified organic, right on the squash, right in the field, and from there on to a truck and out to the warehouse.
From the warehouse cooler, the organic vegetables are shipped to grocery stores for retail sale. Byron's biggest market is in Denver. Overall, Fish says this year's squash crop is in excellent condition, at least in southwestern Colorado. The growing process begins in early April, when Byron starts the plants in greenhouses. They're transplanted to the fields later that month. He says organic squash and cucumbers are relatively easy to grow, but as with any crop, adverse weather and bugs can devastate yields.
In other parts of the country, there's a lot of diseases that attack them, and here we have downy mildew and powdery mildew is the two big diseases, and then the old infamous squash bug, and they get with the program. But we have kind of an innovative scheme to deal with them. We got a battery-operated vacuum cleaner, and we're sucking little rascals right off there, and it's working good.
Like other organic farmers, Byron's crops are grown naturally without the use of chemicals. To avoid damage, he uses a variety of vegetable species that resist certain diseases. While organic farmers may not always be able to match the yields of farmers who use pesticides and insecticides, Fish believes organic farming is the best way to produce food and protect the environment at the same time. It's something his family has done for several generations.
You become dependent on those chemicals if you begin to use them. Like, for instance, the strawberries and tomatoes in Southern California, there's some of the chemicals that the farmers there have used for several years to stop some of the pathogens that's in the soil that now they almost can't grow strawberries and tomatoes without using the chemicals. Well, now, in the near future, them chemicals will likely be banned, and the strawberry and tomato crops in Southern California is in serious trouble. A lot of them is moving to Mexico where there are no restrictions.
For years, organic vegetables have sometimes had external blemishes. However, growing techniques have improved over time, and many of today's organic veggies look as good or better than their chemically grown cousins. While the organic choice is a clear one for consumers who want to ingest less pesticides, the options for the squash bug are more ambiguous. Is it better to get paralyzed by a pesticide and broiled in the hot summer sun, or expire in the confined darkness of a vacuum cleaner bag? It's enough to make any thoughtful squash bug give up squash entirely. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. You're listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, continuing our theme of restoration and renewal, we talk green about sustainable Chattanooga, how the Tennessee city, smothered in pollution, abandoned by heavy industry, has pulled itself up by its bootstraps and is creating a vibrant urban area, and doing innovative things like recycling a dead shopping center to become a new town. And we meet an architect and a professor who say more buildings will be built in the next 50 years than were constructed in the last 5,000. This has huge implications for the environment. Stay with us.
We're talking green, and I'm Stephen Westcott. Today we're talking about Chattanooga, Tennessee. It's a city on the move. 20 years ago, the city suffered from abandoned buildings, rundown riverfronts, pollution, and other problems. It's an example of what happened in some American cities during the post-industrial era, as many factories and businesses closed, with some heading overseas or south, and the high-tech market beginning to emerge. Through a number of initiatives, residents, politicians, and others were able to clean up the city. Many of the problems are fixed, and the city serves as an example of how renewal efforts can work to change the urban environment. So we're going to be talking about how city officials and others cleaned up Chattanooga, Tennessee. Joining me today to discuss this topic are David Crockett, Chairman of the Economic Development, Environment, and Planning Committee, and President of the Chattanooga Institute for Sustainable Development, and Yusuf Hakim, Vice Chairman of the Chattanooga City Council. Both are joining us from that beautiful city. Yusuf Hakim, if I could start with you, paint a picture for our listeners of what Chattanooga looked like, say, 20 years ago.
Well, I think if you look at a city that it appeared to be maybe clouds that are down low, but in reality it was pollution. And we were number one in the nation when it comes to air pollution. Abandoned buildings and neighborhoods were not a priority. So, and we had factories. We were very much a steel mill kind of city, and a number of those closed down. So we do have the brownfield environment that we're trying to overcome. And that's pretty much the way we were.
And if you could tell me, when did renewal efforts really begin, and did citizens play a role in the planning?
You could say approximately 10, 15 years ago when we really got started on the process. And it was actually that, a process where citizens came together to look at where we were, where we wanted to go, and how we went about planning for our future. And we had to identify for the future that niche that we were looking for, and having a problem with the environment, we felt this was one of the major efforts we need to put forward.
David, if you could, tell me, what is the Chattanooga Institute for Sustainable Development, and when was it created?
Well, there have been a number of organizations over our history that have come into being as there was a requirement for them. And the Chattanooga Institute builds on a lot of those. It's mostly a catalytic organization that brings together a focus on issues of sustainability and supports the other organizations in the city of Chattanooga in that regard. It also has national and international partners, and our theme is building sustainable and competitive communities and companies. We are a not-for-profit, privately funded organization that has been in existence about 2.5 years in this form. There were other organizations that preceded it.
And Yusuf, do you think the Institute has been effective, and if so, why?
Without a doubt, it has been effective. Some of the things that they've done really has put Chattanooga on the map in a national and international perspective, allowing people to know some of the things that we're doing here in the city of Chattanooga, inviting them here so they can see firsthand. So it has been a great asset and resource for the city of Chattanooga.
David, before we talk about some of the specific projects, maybe we can talk about money. When you have a city with a lot of problems, finding the money to undertake projects can be an issue. especially if the local economy has been depressed. Where did the money come from to clean up the city?
In most part, the funding has been private and public partnerships, and the great majority of the funding for the riverfront and downtown renewal have come from philanthropic, private, and corporate interest matched strategically with state, local, and a small amount of federal funding. By and large, the formula is more important than the dollar amount of the funding. The fact that we combined public and private resources, not just the funds, but we put together the management and a variety of not-for-profits for housing, riverfront development, downtown development, major urban renewal, and environmental efforts, all of those were public-private partnerships, not the traditional heavy government funding, government-led type efforts.
David, let's focus on some of the changes made in the city. Maybe you can start by talking about the aquarium and the role it played.
I think the aquarium has been a catalyst project for downtown renewal, no question, and it has fit well within the theme of a city that's trying to build a sustainable future by connecting to real important issues. Water is certainly going to be one of the issues of the future, nationally and internationally. It's also been a wonderful educational resource, and it's drawn well over 1 million people a year as tourism, as a major tourism draw, and that has caused a great renaissance of our riverfront and our downtown. But the companion projects of restoring the Walnut Street Bridge, an old automobile bridge, and making it a pedestrian bridge, and creating a national model riverfront along a riverfront that you could not access 8 years ago, making the city more pedestrian, when we look back in 20 years from now, I think could very well have as great an impact on the renewal and restoration and the connection of our people to each other and to the city and to its natural surrounding as the aquarium, perhaps even more.
And did the idea for the aquarium come from children or something along those lines?
But the idea for the aquarium initially was from students, and that's perhaps the genius of any city, is being able to recognize a good idea from whatever its source. The riverfront came from an old fisherman. Great ideas in our Southside project now have come from neighbors, residents, people who lived in our public housing. They have come from students themselves as well as business people. I guess that's probably a hallmark of Chattanooga, is taking ideas from a lot of sources and then having mechanisms in place to implement them.
Another one of the changes that has occurred has been in transportation. Youssef, I understand that there's a new busing system. Is that the case?
Yes, we are very fortunate here in the city of Chattanooga. We're, I guess you could say, the world source of the electric buses here that are leaving here, actually going all over the world. And we have delegations coming in from various places. And it's a bus that, as it said, electric, environmentally friendly, and they're made here in the city of Chattanooga. So not only are we being friendly to the environment, we're creating jobs, and that is something that was very important to defining our niche. It wasn't enough to be environmentally friendly, but to create economic opportunities, and that has transpired also. We have two types. We have battery-operated. There are no lines that go down the streets or anything of that nature, battery-operated. And there are some hybrid models that we have that are gas and battery-powered. And we're looking at some other power sources for the buses. And we've had Japanese and other interested parties to come here to look at them, and you can imagine when the Japanese came in, we felt we really had a project then that the world would look at, and we're trying to stay on the cutting edge of it.
David, I understand there was an old shopping center on the edge of town that was renovated. Can you talk about what happened with that particular facility?
Like most cities across America, we have followed the outward growth patterns where cities grew, like a little bit like pebbles in a pond where you have ripples and the development keeps moving further and further out, and you open another mall or create another housing development further out, and the ones closer in go into decline. Our oldest mall had done that and was not very viable in a commercial sense. And the renovation that took place really was a neighborhood visioning effort that included the entire area around the shopping mall, and a very innovative developer who took that mall and was willing to partner with the city and create a town center. And it's going from being called Eastgate Mall to Eastgate Town Center. That name really describes what is happening with housing, workplaces, as well as retail. And the parking lots will over time be transformed to walking paths and more street-side type parking with parks in them rather than the acres and acres of asphalt that have characterized our cities. It really is a reflection of what Chattanooga and America looked like at the turn of the last century, where there were real communities, and this has given us a chance to renew a whole area as a real community.
For those who may be just joining us, David Crockett is chairman of the Economic Development, Environment, and Planning Committee and president of the Chattanooga Institute for Sustainable Development, and Yusuf Hakim is vice chairman of the Chattanooga City Council. Yusuf, what other projects in Chattanooga have been underway or are taking place now?
Well, we have what's called the Southside development that is taking place. It's taking an area that was, I guess we'll say, somewhat blighted, and we're trying to reinvigorate it. We are reinvigorating the area, firstly through the construction that will take place, over $100 million worth of construction, creating jobs again. And this is the type of thing that we're doing, again, as partnerships between the private sector and the public sector. And one of the other things that we consider major here in the city of Chattanooga is neighborhood revitalization, where we're going into the neighborhoods, planning with individual neighborhoods where they are, where they want to be for the future. And we are providing some small grants to assist in those efforts. This is from the city. And we're trying to make sure that the neighborhoods are cleaned up, vacant houses are either removed or boarded up properly for safety reasons. So we're getting, I think, to the core of revitalization, which is the neighborhoods, where people will feel like all that is taking place impacts them.
David, are there projects that we haven't touched on you think are important you might want to mention?
Well, I think Yusuf has really hit the key to a viable city. Probably three things that we think are breakthrough areas. One is the revitalization of communities and making it possible for people to be real stakeholders in the city. In that regard, we have the largest affordable home ownership program in America, with over $130 million worth of new infill housing or rehabilitated housing for people with low to moderate incomes, and we're talking about the teens to the 20s at the low end of that range. People, these are neighborhoods and redevelopments that have won design awards from the American Institute of Architects and Urban Land Institute. They fit what you want a community to look like, and they make our people feel like the American dream is within reach of all of our citizens. The other breakthroughs are that we're working on is within our South Side, we want it to be a place where people can live, work, shop, worship, play, go to school, and our first Center City school in many years is planned for that area. Housing of all income levels is there. We want to take what we've learned from our own experience and from the experience of others, and try to put in place one place in the city where we can say that's what we want our future to be, not just downtown, but all over the city. We also want the resources there that will help us envision something other than this pattern of sprawl. If all we do is renew the core of the city and make it pretty and not address the neighborhoods and not somehow start building in instead of out, we won't get far.
I've heard that some in Chattanooga's minority community feel the areas in which they live may not have received the same attention in terms of revitalization efforts compared with other parts of the city. Yousef, just briefly, is that the case? Any truth to that?
Well, in Chattanooga, I guess you could say we have a love-hate relationship with government, and there's more organization that is taking place now in the African-American community to address the concerns that you're bringing up. And there has been, in the past, a lack of responsiveness, but we feel today, with the help of the federal government, the hammer, we'll say, that the federal government has over the head of various communities, it plays a part in that. But there's a willingness on the part of government here to work with the community because we want it to be a place where everyone feels like they have a stake.
If I could add to that,
sure,
that the cities that we see in our work with the Institute working across the country, that has been a pattern of America, that the new investment is going further out and not being put in the centers of the city, often where people are disadvantaged. And we have to reverse that. I mean, it's not just for the center city. It's not just for the disadvantaged. It's for all of us. If we have got to do that differently.
David, if there are any city officials in other areas of the United States listening to the program, what advice would you give them in terms of how to take on urban renewal? What did you learn from this experience, or what are you learning?
I think we've learned that just like in a quality system, everybody who's involved in the building of a city, and that's from the residents right up through businesses and government, needs to be at the table. We say we need the shoe test. When you look under the table, you should see all kind of footwear, wingtips, pumps, tennis shoes, hiking boots, and all sizes. You should have a real diversity of people at the table. You should listen carefully to their ideas, be pragmatic, and have the partnerships, we call them public-private, that can implement those ideas. And I think most importantly, we've got to get to a point where we have a common set of values and some guiding principles. Getting the principles and the values right is much more important than any of the projects that we've talked about. Getting those right and building a culture that is inclusive, proactive, and principle and value driven is the most lasting thing we can do in a community.
I want to thank my guests for joining me today. They have been David Crockett, Chairman of the Economic Development, Environment, and Planning Committee, and President of the Chattanooga Institute for Sustainable Development, and Yousef Hakim, Vice Chairman of the Chattanooga City Council. We want to hear what you think. You can call our comment line by dialing 1-888-49-GREEN. That's 1-888-49-GREEN. We've been talking green, and I'm Stephen Westcott.
Share your ideas with us here at the Environment Show. Our address is 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. Email is green@wamc.org. We'll be right back. As you just heard, urban revitalization efforts in Chattanooga, Tennessee are creating a clean, vibrant city environment. The way buildings are constructed in our cities also has an impact, not only in the outdoor environment, but on the people who work and live inside. When I was president of the National Audubon Society, we renovated a 100-year-old structure to create one of the most environmentally advanced and clean buildings in New York City. I recently spoke with two experts on green architecture about how better building design and construction helps the environment. Dr. David Orr is professor and chair of the Environmental Studies Program at Oberlin College in Ohio, where a high-tech, environmentally friendly building is now being constructed. And Randy Croxton is president of Croxton Collaborative, the architectural firm in New York City which designed Audubon House. Green architecture can have a tremendous impact on the environment as a whole. Randy Croxton, you've done some thinking about this. If we were to green up the country, what would it mean in terms of our use of resources and energy?
Well, if we look at just energy alone, if you take the consumption of energy plus the energy that's embodied in materials and the process of construction, extraction of materials, and so forth related to the built environment, we're talking about over 54% of all the primary energy that is consumed in this country every year is going into that built environment. And the level of reductions just through direct efficiency measures, completely cost beneficial, that are easily achieved within this approach are in the magnitude of 60 to 70%. If we push that further and really step into deeper considerations about systems, we can go much further.
So, David Orr, we keep thinking about big global issues, global warming, resource use, and so on. Can greening up American architecture play a role in the big sense of some of these issues, or is this kind of a sideline off in the corner?
No, it's absolutely true. We're preparing, I'm told, to build more buildings in the next 50 years than have been built in the past 5,000. If we build them by the conventional standards, we, again, cast a very long shadow on the prospects of the next generation.
Well, that is one heck of a lot of construction.
That's a lot of construction.
Is there any impetus on the part of architects to really green up their act? I know that, Randy, you've had quite a battle just bringing some of these ideas into focus for the...
Well, I'll tell you, I think we're into the next stage, which is that we have some very powerful leadership projects. Leadership from Audubon on urban renovation, contemporary leadership from Oberlin in a new building, in a campus setting. We have clearly framed the potentials. I think they've been identified. And the next level is to really get deeper into the resistance issues that are built into the way we do buildings, that are built into the culture of those of us who are designing them.
David, how can we break down some of these resistance issues? What's the biggest thing that can happen now so that we can take advantage of
this? Let me say two things. One is that we need examples, and one of the things we've tried to do in the Oberlin Project, and I think you both did in the Audubon House, is provide an example that people could see, touch, feel, and experience. We need more of those, and I think colleges are scheduled to build roughly $17 billion of new construction this year and every year out for the next five. If that was done in accordance with the kind of principles that Randy laid out earlier, I think become very visible and have a major impact.
And what do you say to the folk that say, well, that's a nice idea, but we can't afford it?
Oh, I'd say that's not true at all. I think that green architecture is not only environmentally more benign, but it's also a matter of saving energy, reducing materials, improving performance of buildings, improving the people's performance inside buildings that are healthier, better lit. This is a win-win thing all the way around.
We're just now getting the real cost numbers, because everybody has in the past has been so focused on energy, and we're finding out that 10 times the energy saving easily flows from operation, maintenance, productivity, well-being issues, attendance, and so forth. And these were the numbers that were hard to capture. But as we get more and more examples out there, the results are pouring in that say forget about energy, we've got an exponentially higher return in all of these other areas.
And let me comment on the productivity issue, because I think it's one that people don't often understand. When we finished Audubon House that you designed and had much cleaner air than anybody had ever had inside a built structure, when you finished the day, at the end of the day, you felt better. You just felt substantially different than normally one feels after you spend a day in a New York City office. I mean, it was amazing. And so I presume when you're saying productivity, you're saying people are going to be healthier, and as a result of that, the building pays off that way too.
Exactly. Absenteeism is cut in half. There are many examples. Joe Rahm has a book, Cool Companies, that's coming out this summer, which begins to look across the board at a whole range of buildings at this approach that are creating completely directly measurable bottom line improvement in productivity and work settings and reduced liability.
David, are you seeing that this is something that is popular as you talk to your students?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that Joe Rahm's book, Cool Companies, in fact, is out. And what he's showing is that, and Amory Lovins and other people have shown this for years now, that somewhat higher costs for energy efficiency and daylighting is simply dwarfed by the profits coming from increased productivity, reduced absenteeism, reduced maintenance cost. This is a win-win kind of thing. Green architecture is not an expense, it's a savings.
I've been speaking with David Orr, professor and chair of the Environmental Studies Program at Oberlin College in Ohio, and Randy Croxton, president of the architectural firm Croxton Collaborative. Thanks for being with us in this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. There is no place for organic zucchini in the restored Everglades. But if a revitalized Chattanooga built skyscrapers, the Peregrine Falcons might come. If you don't believe me, order a copy of this show, number 499, and listen again. Call 1-800-323-9262. The Environment Show is a national production which is solely responsible for its content. Alan Shartok is executive producer. Stephen Westcott is producer. The show is made possible by the W. Alton Jones Foundation, the William Bingham Foundation, the Turner Foundation, the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the collector car hobby. www.hemmings.com. Be good to the Earth and join us next week for the Environment Show.